like, what kind of a range are we looking at for this thing? Are we good where we are? Is that what you're taking out?
Yeah, just keep talking.
Steal the other power outlet.
Go for it.
I do have a PowerPoint I actually have to write.
You keep talking every single word in the English translation
it's
out of my
like
head.
What clause, I believe. Someone will be like, well, this happens. You're like what? And then all those examples.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely gone.
I'm the one who has to edit it, so.
Yes.
As long as everyone is talking towards the mic, that's usually all that matters.
And just so you know, okay. I've never been on a podcast before, like myself, so this is really, really awesome.
It's like radio.
I just want to have my like little 10-second gush here of, this is really, really cool. Okay. I'll be professional now.
No. Have fun. That's the more important thing, is to just have fun.
Because that's the funny thing. This podcast is specifically about writers not being professional,
right,
just gabbing.
Yeah,
so it's,
I admit I have a lot of catching up to do on the listening. I swear they are on my iPod, but...
Oh, you're
just,
actually? Oh,
yes.
Then I get to gush a little bit.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm way, way, way behind, but yeah.
Yeah. Feel free to send us feedback. Because we're like, wow, we have over 80 people following us on Twitter, like...
I don't know if you saw, you are on the Awesome Resources for Writers handout at the bottom under Furry.
Ooh.
It's like the Furry Writers Guild and the podcast. So.
Oh, yeah.
Again, I was trying to hit, the gray one with the typewriter font.
Yeah, I know I've bugged Sean and been like, hey, I noticed you have this section on the website. You should put us on there.
Let's see.
Here
it is.
Get a little bit distracted.
I don't know if you grabbed it.
Yeah.
You got one of these or not?
On the episode.
Oh, no, I didn't get one of these.
Yeah.
Yeah, so with Sean, he tends to be distracted because he's actually doing other things. So.
Well, he's got, the poor guy, he's got like two or three jobs. You do have to give him some leeway.
And he doesn't really know his web dev. Like, he's like, I just did whatever I could to make a form.
It's kind of sad because, I mean, you know, God bless them both. The two people who have run it do not have... the experience, and I wouldn't either. So again, I don't blame them for that, but it's just reality. And
yeah,
that's what I was telling Roland, if he wants to work on his web dev.
That's the thing, it's getting him to accept the help and to turn something.
Oh, is he a little bit stubborn on that?
Not in a bad way, but I just mean, you know, that's always the issue. I don't mean to say anything against him as far as I don't think he's resistant necessarily, but it's to show up and to volunteer and to, you know, whatever. So
it's definitely good to have ownership of a project,
right,
and to want to see it through and to want to say, okay, I've taken this on, so I should be doing it. But I've always felt part of doing the ownership thing is definitely knowing when to go, especially with a guild, to go to the rest of the group and say, okay, who can help with this? Who can help with that? The stone soup model is not a bad model for getting things done. It's I don't know if listeners are familiar with the old tale, but it's
the old tale,
the stone soup tale, where
everyone brings something, and
starts out
something
with water, and someone brings a stone along. They say it's a flavor stone.
Well, because
add rich flavor as long as they let it, you know, cook.
The way I always heard it is, it's these three traveling knights come to a town. And at first they try begging for food, and no one's going to, no, you can't come in and have a whole meal, we're just barely scraping by as it is. Mm-hmm. So they go to the center of town, you know, put up a big cauldron or pot or something like that. Well, since no one would share food, I guess we'll just have to all make stone soup. And they just start gathering rocks into the pot and everything like that. One person comes out and you know, says, I'd like to try stone soup, I can even add some turnips, you know. Okay, adding turnips will add much to the stone soup. And slowly but surely, every villager comes out and it becomes a big feast for the whole village because everyone contributed something. And it's a wonderful metaphor for if the whole community gets involved, if everyone does what they can, you get these huge things done.
Like, I think Sean has really taken it over with some gusto. Like, he's pushing the anthology and the awards and that, and it's great.
Yeah.
But what do you guys see as, like, the biggest problem right now?
Well, the biggest problem is activity and involvement level. The problem is we don't agree on how to fix it. And I know that from some of the discussions in the forum, I've probably come off as a major bitch, and I didn't mean to. But I only do it because the guild still means something to me. And I...
Well, you're one of the oldest members.
I was around. Yeah. I was kind of advising Duroc as he set everything up. And so I feel like... I guess I have kind of some ownership in it, too, even though it's not really official. So, you know, that's why I push so hard for, you know, for what it is, for what it's supposed to mean, for what it can be. You know, all that stuff, and it's none of it personal to, you know, anybody. If I, you know, I know there's been back and forth of, you know, with me, with Rifna, with, you know, other, you know, people and whatever, and it's, you know, it's none of it personal, but it's just like, okay, how are we going to get this to what everybody wants it to be, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the problem. But as far as how to get more people involved...
Yeah, that seems to be the biggest issue.
That's the classic question for, like, anything where people have to volunteer.
We want to do all these things, but those things require resources.
Right, and somebody has to head everything up. Somebody has to... I think a lot of it maybe is that... And this was... I was just kind of having a private discussion with somebody about it and kind of realized it myself. I think there needs to be maybe more going either from him or somebody else with some authority level within the guild... to actually go to people directly and ask them to do things, mm-hmm. to go to people, to send them emails and to say, hey, I know you have this skill or that skill, would you be willing to do this? Because if you just say, okay, we're doing this, we need volunteers, everybody else is gonna do, honestly, the same thing I'm doing, they're gonna say, somebody else will do that. Somebody else will take care of that. You go to some, like, you come to me directly and say, will you do this? I'm at least going to give it serious consideration, and if I can, I probably will. And if I don't, I'll at least tell you why I can't. But if you wait for me to volunteer, maybe I will, but, you know, I've got a bunch of other stuff going
on. We're all writers, we're all...
And everybody else is the same way, so, you know, what do you do?
Yeah, and what almost sounds like is needed as far as the guild goes is maybe upon joining or something to be sent out to guild members retroactively is... almost a questionnaire of, you know, do you possess any of these skills?
That's
and,
true,
you know, like, do you know how to web dev? Do you blog? Do you this, that, and the other thing? And then, based on that questionnaire, if you need web dev help, you send it to the three people, you know, who listed it as, yes, I'm top tier. You say, are you willing to do this? Kind of like you said, you know, asking directly.
Going directly.
But... you can't quite go directly until you know the skills someone has.
Right, that's true.
If someone says, can you do web dev? I can take a Word document and save it as an HTML. That's the best you're going to get, which is going to suck.
So, I can center things and make them bold.
I can add the blink text to this, you know, stuff on this website here.
I can make the text green with a red background. It'll
show
up well.
There you go.
Yes. I think one of the best things Sean has done is open the forums.
Yeah, because I had not realized how not functional the forums have been, because I personally was not having problems getting in them until about the last month when, like, nobody could get to them. And then it was like, okay, this is really a problem. But I hadn't realized that I guess it had been that way for some time before where nobody knew could join, and I had no idea that it was
when I was
that
still...
was a total, you know...
I know when I was still starting up, looking at furry writing, I'm like, oh, you Google furry writing guild comes up, and you look at it, and you're like, oh, I have to be published. So as someone who's trying to get into that, how do I look at this, and they're like, sorry, you have to be good enough first to come in.
It feels like the catch-22, where it's like, we have all these tips on getting published, but you have to have already been published.
Right, and that's why we wanted the forums there in the beginning. We wanted the idea of, you know, we need a place for exchange, we need a place... to, you know, to have critique, to have things like that that is open to everybody who wants to just come and register on the forums. Unfortunately, that kind of gets to be a point of confusion, because I worry that people think that the forums are members only, you know, and it's not, so.
Yeah, but that's kind of the reason we mentioned it during the panel today, is that if you're looking for, you know, how to find opportunities.
Yeah,
I know we've said on the podcast, too, like, because other than finding some group people near you or your own writing group, where there's no real good centralized place.
Yeah.
So hopefully that forum can at least be a start.
I hope that the furry writers market kind of gets back into being updated and kept up, because that, even way back before the guild existed, that was what I always wanted as a writer. I need a place to where I know which publishers and which anthologies are open, rather than having to go to everybody's blog and everybody's websites and everybody's Twitter feeds. And, you know, to me, that is really one of the most valuable things that we have, is to have that information in one spot for people who are looking to get published then.
And of course,
go ahead,
Giannis.
Oh, I'm the one here. The fact that they include not just the officially furry marketplaces, but things that are tangential, like shapeshifter fantasy that might allow
the
for
furry
animal
tolerant,
characters.
Basically, something that crosses over. Yeah.
Well, it's great because there is so much crossover.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I know, on the whole guild remark, I know, for example, the Science Fiction Writers of America, that they have the same thing where they require you to be published. I think the Romance Writers of America do the same thing, mm-hmm. but having open forums like that, because I don't think, for example, the Science Fiction Writers of America has anything.
No,
like
it's closed.
They don't really have external resources for people to utilize. So that really is an advantage. It's just something that needs to be managed on a day-to-day basis. In the end, it goes from having to become more of a full-time job. I think that's the complication.
And it is time-consuming.
So
to do it.
One of the things that I like is I think it was you and a few other people were posting some of the kind of cross. Hey, these other people have this other stuff that's open, consider it. And hopefully, because of speculative fiction also adopting a lot of the anthropomorphics indirectly, hopefully that'll help, like you said, kind of bring the market up a little bit more, at least help us integrate it in more into something that's more mainstream. And I guess we'll find out what that does. I know I'm going to Worldcon this fall, so we'll see.
Lucky.
We'll see how that changes. We'll see how much it's changed, and I've heard a variety of things about WorldCon and who it's mostly composed of. So I guess we'll see if that's true too. So, not all of it's been very positive.
And
so.
That's one of the things that I try to do, and I hope I never come across to people that I'm trying to like act like I'm bigger than I am, or this may just may also be a kind of female thing. But I feel like I have to look as professional as I can look. Because I write things that are very easy to not take seriously. And I feel like I have to try to look like somebody who can be taken seriously. I want to look more like a science fiction or fantasy writer than I necessarily look like a quote-unquote furry writer, whatever that looks like. You know, so I have to try to look, okay, I want to use my real name. You know, I want to use my picture on my Twitter feed. I want to approach this like what I write in the furry fandom is as taken as seriously, at least by me, than the stuff that I write that gets published in, you know, the science fiction and fantasy markets, which some is kind of the same thing. But so for me, it's kind of an image thing. I have to think, okay, not in the sense that I want to come across as being really stuffy or really, you know, anything like that, but it's just I have to kind of be aware of what am I projecting here. You know, to somebody who might come into this or into this website or into whatever and not know about furry, how do I want to present it? You know, do I want to make a big deal out of it, or do I just do like what I've been doing and the furry anthologies and my regular anthologies go on my books page of my website and they're all listed next to each other and, you know, there they all are, so.
And it's kind of interesting looking at it from the fact that some of the stuff we were talking about with Sci-Fi Writers of America not being as open as I thought. When we look at as a genre, as a grouping, as a marketplace, how young furry is, essentially, and how that impacts what we see in some of the openness, the way things are marketed, the way on which we try to bring things out. Because my personal model, the way I do my marketing, things like that, I have my two identities, essentially. And it's not even there to say, I don't want anyone to know about, you know, this or the other, because if someone asks me, it's like, you know, Giannis and Mark are the same person. it's more of a, if you pick up something written by Yannis J. Wolfe, you know exactly what you're getting. This is what you go to, even if you're fully aware that they're the same person, this is what you get for, you're getting furry fiction. And it's anthropomorphic animals, it's, you know, fitting into these genres, things like that. If you pick up something by Mark W. Coulter, you know it's probably going to be more in the mainstream, in the horror vein, things like that. So, and then going ahead with those two identities, having the separation but not the hiding,
right,
is what kind of works for me, but it
but
allows
there, there
the
are
different...
other authors out there. Yeah. Like I have one friend and she has, I believe, 6 different pen names for 6 different types of writing.
Right, because it's a type of branding, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
you do. You expect a certain type of thing from, you know, this particular pen name. So I know I say, okay, yes, I write everything under my own name. I never come down on, you know, people for using,
yeah,
pen names, because there are a lot of really legitimate reasons,
mm-hmm,
to use, you know, a pen name. It's just, for me, it's like, okay, I'm also lucky enough that what I write does kind of cross over a lot. You know, it does kind of, there is stuff that I can publish both places.
I don't actually know about this, but about you, but are you a full-time writer, or do you also have a job?
I wish. I have,
okay,
a day job. I work as a medical transcriptionist, so I type about 7 hours a day.
And then you go home and type more.
I'm probably going to have carpal tunnel like 5 to 10 years. I'm just already anticipating that, so, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wish. I used to be able to work part-time and got a lot more writing done, but I do have a full-time day job.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, it's frustrating,
yeah,
for people like me where... Unfortunately, I'm a very low energy person,
mm-hmm,
in a job that requires a lot of high energy, because I am an information technology professional, but unfortunately my job requires that I be hyper flexible in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that today they're planning on me to go to one client, you know, somewhere in the wonderful city of Baltimore. And then that same afternoon they may say, oh no, we're sending you to New York City instead, you know, in 2 days, because we want you to do this. And then the very next day they may say, no, we canceled that, we gave it to someone else. You're going down to Raleigh tomorrow, so figure it out. And unfortunately, it's one of those trade-offs, so I can only imagine. I hope that other people don't have to deal with that, because it's not very fun. And thankfully I did recently manage to bang out a bit of a story that I still need to get back to editing. But it's very challenging, for sure, when you can't block out time like that. Once you get into a pattern, it's great, but it's very hard for me personally. So I don't know if you find it the same way, or if anybody else finds it the same way.
The other thing, and this is getting into like an individual process thing again, I'm not like a 15-minute-a-day writer. I can't just like shift focus and do the little chunks like everybody says, oh, if you write one page a day, then at the end of the year, you'll have an novel. No. It doesn't work that way. I need like at least an hour.
Yeah.
More like a couple of hours is better. So I do, most of my writing is on, you know, my days off. And usually not on the days off that my husband is also off. So, you know, because I also have to be more or less alone. I've tried the coffee shop writing thing. I am way too self-conscious to do that, because I am often feeling whatever's getting onto the page, and I don't want somebody having to stop me and saying, ma'am, are you okay, because you're sitting here crying, you know, staring at this computer screen, like, no, I'm fine, you know, I don't want to get into that. So I just stay at home and write.
I'm right there with you, because I need that extra time, number one, to do what I've started to call opening the portal, where there's this world that I'm looking on. There are these characters that are talking to me. Usually then they're sitting in the waiting room in my head when they're not doing the other stuff.
Listening to Muzak.
listening to Muzak. And now it's gotten to the point where this almost sounds schizophrenic, but most writers do at some point. I have another character in my head who is Doris the DMV lady, who her whole job is to sit there and basically go, look, sir, I understand, but the author is one person. He will get to you as soon as he, excuse me, hey, you, no, you stop. You cannot kill anyone who is not in your own universe. Go back, no, put him down.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
No, you've got to fill out Form B-52 first.
Yes, it's like that. But then it's the, like you said, I can't do the coffee shop thing because I'm feeling whatever I'm putting onto the page. I really can't do the coffee shop thing for certain sorts of things that aren't right. But yeah, I need that time to open the portal, and I don't know if any of you have also experienced this. I'd love to hear people talk about it. You've spent the 10, 15, 20 minutes, however long. You've just started to get in the mode. You get 250 words, ringing phone, knock at the door. Any of you have the same thing?
Yeah, I've had that happen. When I was writing the one story that I need to actually get back to editing, and I'll try not to talk too much about it based on some other things that I read, where it's the more you talk about stuff that you haven't finished, the more you think it's finished. But it's like Ocean and I would be talking about something or other, and then I'd go quiet for like an hour or whatever it was, and then I'd get back to him, and so he knows what it's like to deal with me, because I've managed. Initially, I had that problem.
That's you in a 24-hour schedule, the levels.
Yeah, that's also the other problem with me is, in order to write, I have to choose whether I'm sacrificing sleep or whether I'm going to be lazy with work, because I work out of my apartment. That's the problem. Because I'm supposed to be mobile, I'm at home, I have a desk, and my work machine sits there, and I respond to emails. Thankfully, it's a weekend, so my phone, which I have with me, isn't dinging all the time, because that would really piss me off. But, you know, and there were work nights where I'd be sitting talking to Ocean, and it would be like 10 o'clock, 10:45, and I'd sit there, and I'd be trying to piece everything together, and I would hear the ding, and I'd look, but for some odd reason, I figured out a way to make my brain go, you're ignoring that for right now, and then just keep focusing on writing. I don't know how I did it. Maybe it's the DMV person in my head is a lot meaner. Maybe they're like, no.
It's actually a drill sergeant.
Yeah, it might be drill sergeant, you know. I bet you think you're funny. it's whatever his name is. And so every single character in my head is another Gomer Pyle, right? But I have run into that before. The coffee shop stuff does not absolutely work for me for that reason. When I was writing in a coffee shop, I was only cranking out anywhere between 250 to 750 words that were actually decent for anything. When I went back to writing at home, it was slow at first, but within the first couple of nights that I started writing that story, I was already back up to 1,000 words. And then I was up to 1,500 within a couple of weeks on that on average, and there was, I think the highest night was like 2,300 or 2,000 or something. But it's over a few hours between taking breaks to respond back to people who were probably like, you know, what the heck are you doing? Why aren't you responding to me? Are you ignoring me? You're a jerk. That sort of thing. But I've run into that. I don't explicitly know how I corrected it, but somehow my brain figured out how to correct it.
I tend to use music a lot. Either both music while writing, like the story I was been finishing recently, I had, you know, Pandora and the headphones on and, you know, working on it there. The other thing though is I will sometimes find, and usually this just sort of happens, I don't have to go looking for it, some kind of like a theme song for the project. You know, some kind of song that to me encapsulates, or sometimes it becomes a whole playlist, sometimes it's just, you know, one particular instrumental piece, something like that. And that becomes kind of the Pavlovian thing that can get you back into the story then, that puts you back into that mood.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because I've had that too, where the story will just take on even a lyrical song sometimes, where if I start with that and then have my instrumental playlist, you know, ready to go afterwards, it will set me flowing into that particular story's world, and then I can just, I don't necessarily notice the instrumentals, but they're helping give a rhythm to everything.
I like to make a playlist, especially if there's a specific genre. Like when I did Pulp, I think I still have like a whole Western, like the good, the bad, and the ugly, and everything, and just anything, and I would just put it on, and it'd be like, yes.
I will admit that as I'm editing Pulp, I've had a few movie themes and everything like that, and one of the things where it's like, my sister finally, for my birthday, got me all the Indiana Jones music that I've been wanting, like the collector's edition for a while, so it's just like, ripped, put it on, and I'll be good to go.
I get really frustrated because everyone I talk to who's a writer is like, yeah, I put on music, and I can't do that. I need, like, complete quiet and complete isolation. And so that is, like, one of the things that, like, really frustrates me. I'm like, why can't I be like that? Because finding complete quiet is a lot harder than being able to put on music and tuning out whatever else is going on around you. At least that's what I would think.
Noise-canceling headphones and things like that can help,
yeah,
too. Both, both like, sound-wise and also psychologically, too.
Yeah.
Well, in your case, if you need the absolute silence, depending on where you have a place to write and everything like that, have you experimented with just putting in earplugs before you write?
I have not.
I'm a firm believer in writing being such an individual thing. Experiment with everything. Experiment with whatever's going to get that story out.
Process is personal.
Oh,
yes. There's all kinds of rules and guidelines and regulations for craft, but process is completely personal.
And the other thing is, too, is process, and I've experienced this partially, process can sometimes vary between story to story.
Yeah.
So, for example, the story I keep talking about and I keep promising I'm not going to, I actually used several soundtracks. I used a soundtrack, a combination of a soundtrack and a minimalist composer named Max Richter, who wrote something called The Blue Notebooks, I think is what it was. And so that entire track is what I wrote the majority of the story to, but I also used the soundtrack from Touchback, which was a horrible movie apparently, but the soundtrack had enough elements that related to the particular setting and the particular sort of feel that the story has. And so I was able to utilize those elements from both of those pieces, from going from the extreme of minimalist music, not extremely minimalist, but minimalist music, to this kind of rich soundtrack, stereotypical romantic period type of soundtrack. That was about football, of all things. So it's kind of weird, but there are others.
The man wearing the football jersey.
Yes, the Firebirds jersey. But the other thing is there are other stories that I've composed where there was one that I wrote. I sat down, I wrote 2,500 words in the span of an hour for just on one flash or 90 minutes or something like that. And for that one, I had to listen to. I forget what the exact name of the track was, but there are three tracks in the Star Trek soundtrack that just absolutely worked for it. And those were the only three tracks that worked. So I couldn't listen to anything else while cranking that out. Nalen the Kelvin. Nalen the Kelvin was one of them, and then it was some other track. There's a third story that I worked on where I couldn't listen to anything, where the character actually had a synesthesia. They were born blind, but whatever they heard came up as color in their vision. So it's I couldn't listen to anything while writing that, though, which is bizarre, but it's three different ways of dealing with where it's I have to have a combination for one, three specific songs for another, and then nothing for the third. So that's I don't know if any of you have run into that with any. I'm sure most of you have written far more than I have. So
yeah, because every story presents its own set of problems and challenges, and the thing that worked for you for the last three stories all of a sudden doesn't work anymore, you know. So yeah, you have to kind of try something different then.
Yeah, it's and sometimes for me it's even a difference in the way I'm sitting in my chair or the way I, you know, I'm trying to think of all the other different variances that have happened.
I know for me one of them is clothing, depending on the clothing level, will factor in and because that impacts comfort level, I guess, but.
The first thing is I have to be comfortable. I can't have any nagging like the, you know, a tag at the back of the shirt or something like that. However I can just be comfortable, so that's not going to pull me out of the world. But, there are so, story to story, character to character. Some characters just won't talk to you unless you do, you know, whatever their bizarre summoning rituals.
My story for Pulp, I had one character who would not talk to me at all until I knew his name. Once I knew his name, everything else fell into place. but until there was a name there, I couldn't just do like I do for other stories and just type, asterisk, and then just go back with, find a replace and fill it in later. I couldn't do that. It was just...
See, I chuckle about that because I ended up not giving my main character a name. I was just like, he's just a hunter for now, and I'll figure it out later, and all the beta reads came back, and they're like, yeah, you don't need to give him a name.
Well, I mean, the classic Western series of The Man with No Name, the Clint Eastwood... cannot say the director's name. I should be able to say it. Marcone, I want to say it. But the classic Clint Eastwood trilogy. The hero never had a name, and it's a classic. So
sweet, I got an extra trope in there.
Yeah. So, and that's what I find is also interesting, where characters tell me things about the story that I had apparently been planning for but didn't know I was planning for.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of fascinating when that happens.
That's also always interesting when you're trying to solve a problem and the character's, well, like, I would just do this, and you're like, oh, that works. That's, why didn't I think of that?
I tell this story a lot in panels when I'm talking about the whole listening to your characters thing. The time when I was working on a Sherlock Holmes story, and I had read so much Sherlock Holmes the 2 months before that... I'd become so inundated with it that halfway through the story, I was trying to get him from point B to C, and he stood up, stopped all the action. It was literally like just a freeze frame, and said, no, I wouldn't do that. But I have this plan, and I have this, no, we can still go with your plan. It's just I would say this to try and get them to do this in this order. That's a lot more clever than what I had. Well, of course it is. I'm Holmes. Yeah, I just see people nodding around me, just like, we've been there.
That's amazing when you create that character and you're like, you're in my mind, right? I made you, why are you telling me what to do?
Well, that's why it's so fascinating to me, because it was working with a character that I didn't create. That was what I don't know if I had absorbed just enough in reading or what have you, because I felt I really had to respect the Doyle originals, because I'm playing in his yard there. I am working with something he created, and I have to respect that he's the original creator. So when that happened, I just kind of figured, okay, this is residual of trying to soak up all of that.
Because you're going to absorb more than you're ever aware of when you're really that deep into... reading and rereading and rereading. I mean, I did that with Kipling when I did a story called The Tiger's Son, which kind of twists the Mowgli stories.
Hmm.
So.
Yeah, that tweet's not important.
Sorry, I have a compulsive... Oh! How very meta.
Now I'm curious.
Everyone just stops to read.
I don't have internet.
The funny thing is,
have a smartphone or anything.
This will happen while we'll be recording. Is like someone will mention we'll be recording. Someone will be like recording with Fangs and Fonts, and so like three of our phones were like, oh.
Yeah.
I'm like, edit.
We got hashtagged.
But now the conversation is too amusing to edit, so you have to leave it in.
Yeah.
And then your listeners are all going, why is there all this stuff? Or possibly they're not, so.
Yeah.
Depending on how much they've listened to.
Oh, Twitter stop.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really annoying when you have a character who does something that you don't want them to do. Like, I had a character who... at the end of the story, he ended up converting, and I didn't feel like I wanted that to happen, even though I don't... mind religion. I was like, I don't think this is right for the market. I don't think the market that I want to sell this to will like it. So don't do that. And it's just,
but
I had to do
I
it.
Need to Friday.
Yeah, like I was like, yeah. I have to. Like, I know this character well enough. It's what he's gonna do, and it's what is right, and it's what works for the story, but I want there to be something else. And
Yeah, when we've all had to do that at some point where we go, this is different from the market that I'm writing for, but I have to be true to the story because that's more important.
Yeah.
Because there's always going to be another market later on.
Oh, yeah.
There's always another option. So if you end up with something that's like, okay, this just doesn't work anymore, 6 months later, there may be another call for submission someplace, and you send it out there, and it's perfect. So.
Well, yeah, like when you guys were talking about rejection today, and like when it gets rejected, that's not the end of the world. You can just, you've got a story still. You can still fix it up,
yeah,
send it out somewhere else.
The, one of the best metaphors that I've heard about rejection was that, assume that when you get the story back, you've basically, this was told back when all the submissions were sent by actual postal mail, but assume that you've just received this back and it has just been stamped, the editor who can appreciate this work and who is a good fit for this work is not at this address. It just come back to you stamped not at this address, send it back out again, and maybe that'll be the right address. So it's, rejection is, it's a disappointment. It's kind of a bee sting, It's like you let yourself feel the disappointment, and then you move on and you find, where do I send it out next?
But I just realized that reminds me of programming, because any true programmer just knows the amount of horrible bugs and compiler issues and everything that you're going through and just frustrating yourself to no end. I've had people ask, like, why do you do this? It's so frustrating, like, one little thing and everything's wrong. And you're like, because when you get it right and everything works and it does what you want it to do, greatest feeling in the world. And it's just like that acceptance letter. You're just like,
oh, yeah.
Done.
Yeah. And thankfully, the acceptance letter feeling is one that just, how some things, the first time you get it, it's like, woohoo! And then the next time you get it, it's, great, and then so on until it's like,
good.
I don't think the acceptance letter feeling gets old. That's one of the great things about it, is that it's, anytime it happens, it's, yes, everything went through.
Yeah.
Victory lap.
I have this one poor little story that I still like it. I love it. It has gotten through to the last round on someone's project twice. On one project, it was, we really liked it, it made it through the last round, in the end it didn't fit with the rest of the anthology. Then there was another, I figured, okay, I'll, take out some of the specifics in it that were for this project and then submit it to another horror anthology. A year later, about the same thing. This was fun, we liked it, it just didn't quite fit. And I look at this poor story and I go, you have a home. You have a home somewhere. We're this close. But it's almost, it's better than getting the first round rejection, but it's almost tougher to be like that so close.
There's a question that I'm burning to ask, so I guess I might as well ask it, and it mostly has to do with stories and anthology placement. And the question is mostly, have you guys ever experienced where you've written a story and it's not that there isn't necessarily going to be something in the future, it's that you expect that there's probably going to be, that there is nothing really for it and you don't expect there to be anything for it. Have you ever written a story like that where it's either so cross topic within the specific greater genre that it can't quite fit anywhere, or that it doesn't have a specific genre? Like, I know speculative fiction is used to label a lot of stuff that doesn't fit anywhere, for example.
So, in other words, you're writing a story that you know is really not going to fit
right.
any place. I guess I'm just always optimistic that there is going to be a place for it somewhere, and part of it is the thing that I really like about the e-publishing and the e-books and the self-publishing and a lot of the stuff that's come up. I feel like that, in a way, to me, and this may not be a great way to look at it in some ways, it's like a safety net. It's like, if I send it out everywhere and nobody wants it, I can always put it out there myself. There's always going to be a way to get something to the readers. And if, obviously, I want it to be at that top-tier market, or I want it to be somewhere down my list of markets, I would like to get paid for it if I can get paid for it. But if all else fails, there's going to be some way to get this out to people who want to read it. And then if I'm the only one who wanted to read it, then great. It'll be there on my website or wherever it is, and it'll be there, and maybe 3 years from now, somebody will make a comment or email me and say, hey, I really like this. And, you know, that's something too, so.
Yeah. Well, and the other good thing about stories like that where maybe they didn't find a home, but you've looked at it, your beta readers have looked at it, and you feel they're good stories. Like you say, Renee, with the self-publishing, that option. One of the things that I'm kind of stealing from MCA Hogarth held a brilliant panel on Business for the Creative Brain at Anthrocon about 2 years ago, and talking about why giving away stories is a good thing. Why putting it up on your website for free, because maybe it didn't find a home somewhere on the anthology you originally wrote it for, and you don't feel it's going to fit into another anthology. But it's just a here to people who like my stuff or who aren't sure if they want to try it out. Here's something, a full story, beginning, middle, to end, for free. And even if you get two readers who look at it and go, you know, I really like that. Maybe I should go buy some more stuff by this author. That's a win. That's sales you didn't have before of your material. So I'm stealing that from her, but I will give MCA Hogarth full credit for it because it was a brilliant statement and needs to be out there.
And for me too, that's also a great thing reprint-wise.
Mm.
You know, I try not to be satisfied by something being published once. You know, it's like, as long as it's, you know, within the confines of the contract and I'm not, you know, stepping on anybody's toes, okay, that's a story that either, you know, I can try to send out to editors as a reprint, or, you know, I can put it together as an ebook with some other stories. You know, I can do something else with that later on too, so.
Well, yeah, and well, and after a while, having your own collection of short stories, because if you, even like famous big name authors, you know, I'll just go with Stephen King because we've all seen collections of his short stories. If you look at the credit page of that collection that still sells and still brings him, you know, money every year, like he needs it, it will say, you know, title of story. First published in da-da-da magazine. Title of story, first published in da-da-da anthology. That's how you get a collection of short stories from all the ones that have either been published before or didn't quite make it, so, yeah.
So someone needs to make a furry monocon.
Hmm?
So someone needs to make a furry monocon, basically.
Well, I know, like, yeah. There is the Kyle Gold Standard, which is essentially just a bunch of short stories and a great marketing tool. Like, hey, if I believe you read it, it's like, if you like this story, there are three other stories that relate to this story, like, in the continuation, and I believe that's free, so it's...
Yeah, and I kind of did the same thing. I have Six Impossible Things, which is a free ebook that's on Amazon and Smashwords and Apple and wherever, and that's kind of the same thing. It's pretty much all reprints. It's six stories. It just meant I created that with the idea, this is a sampler, this is something I'm going to give away for free, with the idea of, you know, here's something to try.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's almost kind of a portfolio, too, because, you know, I you know, meet up with somebody new or I'm exchanging emails with them. It's like, well, you know, if you want to get an idea of what I write, you know, this is, you know, a way to do it that's nice and convenient and put it on your e-reader and there you go, so.
Yeah.
Something I wanted to ask at the publishing panel today, because it was right near the end. Like, what about teasers? Is that up to the publisher? Like, if you want to go, I have a story, it's going to be published, here's a paragraph.
Like the 1,000 words preview.
Like, I believe you have one for Hellhound.
Right. It kind of depends on the publisher, and it's one of those if in doubt, ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I admit I'm kind of bad sometimes about not asking, so, you know, I probably need to get more in the habit, but I generally figure anything that's like 10% or less, you're not going to get into trouble with, because at that point, it really is just a teaser.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that, you know, if you're posting it somewhere, you're also putting the links to where this thing is available, because that's what you want people to do. Read it. Here's where you order it. You know, this is where it's been published. It's been published in this anthology by this press. Here's their website, you know, because that's really, you know, what you're doing. But I think, you know, especially in furry, I mean, you know, how do you get the word out about this stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, we've got to be in there and, you know, and trying to help out, you know, as much as we can and put stuff on there. So, you know, I hope I haven't stepped on anybody's toes editorially from putting stuff up, but, you know, I try to keep it to a short length and end it on a nice little cliffhanger, you know, spot somewhere that'll make people want to keep reading, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, and that's the... Because originally, I think you had told me that you were looking at putting up a 1,000-word, and then I, from an editor's standpoint, I loved the idea because it was one of those moments of, why didn't I think of this before? Why didn't I tell people to do this? So then I went back and talked to the publishers and said, you know, hey, Renee has this idea. What do you think of me telling everyone to do this? They thought it was perfect because it's a better way to sell more books. So then I just sent a mass email to all the authors saying, okay, update, here's what we have going on, and if each of you want to do this, here's a couple potential icons, here's the whole cover of the book if you want to make your own smaller icon out of it, and it worked out well because most of the authors put it up, and I think that helped drive sales.
Well, because the authors want to get recognized as well.
And
right?
Every author has their circle of readers, and some of those don't necessarily overlap, so you know, it's kind of cross-promoting everybody's, you know, work and the same thing. I may be reaching people that, you know, the other authors aren't reaching, and vice versa, so.
Yeah, well, it really is kind of like, it's like, you and I, for argument's sake, tend to write in different genres, different styles, things like that. But if everyone who likes our stuff winds up buying the book, that's great for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's just, yeah.
So do you think we'll see something like that for Pulp when it gets around?
When
after we play the waiting game?
When all the editings are done and everything, yeah, I will be encouraging people to do preview sections of stories and things like that, too. Because it preview sections as well, in my opinion, are the entire... Because the market has changed and it's gone to ordering online, buying online, and things like that, one of the things I always liked about brick-and-mortar bookstores, I can go in, I can thumb through a book and read the back of it, you know, thumb through, read like look at the first chapter, get an idea. That's what the sampling replaces. Because in a lot of cases, a lot of people don't have the opportunity to thumb through the furry books. They have to kind of guess and go and order online. So that's, people have always been able to read a sampling of a book. This is just the modern version.
Yeah, it's a great tool because, A, you know, you want to be sure with your purchase that you're buying something you're going to enjoy. And, like, especially with novels, I like when they're like, here's the first two chapters or something. You could read it and go, obviously I'm not going to like this, so, or this sounds great. You feel a lot better buying that product or not buying that product. Versus, I'll take a chance, you know.
Yeah.
I've just, my mind is going back to the brief stint that I did judging for a few months, judging books for a prize, where it was very interesting because literally it was not having the luxury of having that preview. It was, oh no, here are your books, you're judging them. And from that perspective, yes, I can, now that I think about it from an electronic perspective, having that preview, and authors that don't have that preview tend not to look at it. Especially, for example, I'm going to use Amazon as the intentional case there because Amazon has that look inside.
Mm-hmm.
And for books that don't have that, now that I think about it, I tend not to buy those. I tend not even to look at them. Whereas in a brick and mortar, if I've looked at a book and I've done that, or I'm familiar with it because someone else has let me thumb through their copy, it makes me more inclined to want to buy it. So that's actually a really good thing. Just from even my perspective, which is more of a reader at this point.
Oh, yeah. With contracts and dealing with, like you said, with Rabbit Valley, how you're like, whoa, total exclusion.
Yeah.
And I know with Pulp, when you were portraying it for submissions, it's like, you can use a character, like, I don't want the whole series, but just a chunk out of that. Later, you could write more for that. Now, do the contracts in that, say I have one character in one story and I want to write it in for another story, you know, same character, would I have to use the same publisher because of the contract?
That is kind of honestly a tricky thing for me to say or even try to answer because I'm not an expert on complete copyright law, and I will readily admit that, because In essence, with a work-for-hire contract, it is kind of a lock, stock, and barrel deal where, you know, this setting, this everything that you've written becomes the property of the publisher. Now, I know the guys at Rabbit Valley, and the intent is not to lock you out of your own creations. The intent is not to have something they can hold over your head where if you write a completely different story in the same world with the same character, they can go, well, that character belongs to us, so, et cetera, and so on. But I know it's also, for a lot of writers, it feels like a risky proposition if they don't personally know the people that they're signing the contract
right.
with.
And,
so,
and my thing is just, you know, I mean, I have to go by what's on the paper. You know,
yeah.
Intent is great, and I know that their intent is not to do any of that, but it's still what's on there that's got my signature on it, and I have to, you know and be comfortable with what I'm signing, because they can say, oh, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this, and I can believe them when they say that we're not going to do this, but, you know, there's the words on the paper, basically, that's the contract, so... They may have the right to do it, whether or not they actually do it, and I may not be comfortable with them having the right to do it.
There is the spirit in the letter, and the letter is the
right.
final say.
Well, and that's the other factor is when you look in terms of perpetuity long term, it's also one of those things of, in this case, the odds are good that there's no other entity that is ever going to buy the brand name, company, etc., things like that. But with another company, if you have a similar contract with, the best example I can think of is, let's say you were in the old days of working for, like, Wizards of the Coast or something like that, and you, because you knew people who own Wizards of the Coast, you were okay with, okay, you know what, I will create these things work for hire because we're all trying to do the same thing, we're a good bunch of people. Now, if memory serves, Wizards of the Coast is technically owned by Hasbro. It's one of the major toy companies owns Wizards of the Coast. That means they own all the Wizards of the Coast property, which means they own that intellectual property lock, stock, and barrel, if the contracts work for hire. That's where I think a lot of writers get really nervous about signing a work for hire deal is what happens in the future.
Yeah.
What could happen in the future through no fault of the, you know, people with good intentions and everything like that. So
yeah.
It's tricky.
Like, I know for Punk'd, one of the writers was, like, kind of with the teaser idea. He's like, I'd like to write a prequel, maybe throw it out for free or something as a way. And, like, would that conflict, I guess? It's something you should go to the publishers about, I'm assuming. But if you know, for randomly, if I wrote a prequel to my story for Pulp and then put it up and say, oh, Pulp's coming out, here's kind of a prequel, as still completely standalone story, than what I've submitted there. Is that back to the hazy territory of who knows?
It's, and again, that really depends on the individual contract that you sign, because if, and like Renee said in the panel,
mm-hmm.
if the contract can be negotiated by talking with people, and especially if it becomes a right to publish contract, exclusive right to publish this story, then prequels are a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
Prequels and sequels, it doesn't matter what else you're doing with the character, because the only rights, you know, the only rights that you're signing away are the right to first publication and exclusivity for a certain number of years.
For that particular story.
For that particular
not
story,
for the
not
character,
for the characters,
not for
yeah.
the world, just for this piece of text. So,
is there a contract panel yet?
Maybe next year. We probably, I'd want to, if I were going to do a contract panel, I would want to find at least one person to sit on it who has studied copyright law for years to actually, and who's really good at putting it into lay terms. Because while I know I know just enough to get myself and other people in trouble, quite honestly.
You still have that asterisk
like,
that's like...
I know enough to know what to avoid, but not necessarily,
yeah,
you know, explain why of every single point and know all the scenarios that can come into play, you know, afterwards.
Now if I were talking to someone at a party or a, you know, creative gathering or something like that, and they said to me, yeah, I'm a furry, and I also, in my day job, I do contract law and copyright law. Mm-hmm. I'd start grinning and say, hey, have you ever run a panel?
Yeah.
Hey! Guy, friend, let's talk.
What can we do for you to bring us to our convention? What can we do for you?
There's a reason that lawyers get paid so much.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah.
They speak a completely different language than us.
Yeah, it's... I would pay one for the same reason that I would pay someone to translate Japanese into English. I don't understand it. I'd like to.
All right, and I actually have a panel at 4:30 that I have to duck out for.
Okay.
So, but thank you for...
Oh, no problem. Thank you. It was wonderful having you.
Yes, yeah, sorry if I asked inane questions that were stupid.
No, you did not.
You're great.
I would say if I can come back later. Well, I guess if my panel ends early, but my guess is you guys will be onto other things. Onto various and other sundry fun things, and I will just be locked in the operations closet again.
We'll come visit you.
Hello?
Locked in the closet.
Can anyone hear me?
I put down my gun!
Oh, jeez, where have I been?
John O'Connor's locked in the closet.
I'd like to requisition another serval, please.
You'll need form B-44.
You're gonna need form B-44. Don't forget to get the addendum 1042.
I'm sorry, this isn't duplicate. You need triplicate.
You need triplicate, and then you need quadruplicate for this other one, and we need a DNA sample. Please step over to the bathroom. All right, guys.
Still working on your story? Oh, what?
Pretty much sending it now, actually.
And then, for heaven's sake, don't look at it again afterwards, because then you'll notice the typo that you didn't see.
I've submitted it in Comic Sans for some how.
Yeah, exactly.
How? No.
That's why there's
I just want to run to the server and just be like, no, don't send the email. No.
I did that with a story recently, and it didn't, thank goodness it was flash fiction, but it lost all of my paragraph breaks. So it was just like one big, and I'm like, okay, first off, I hate you, Word. Second, I hate you, my email program that I'm trying to paste from Word that's not working.
I saw that tweet.
Yeah, so
like,
yeah, and I'm
no.
just like, good, but you know, it was okay because they didn't take it anyway. And I don't think it was because of that, so you know, all right, fine.
I think the two slogans should be, there's the fuck it, ship it, and then ship it and forget it.
Yeah. Yep. Kind of lather, rinse, repeat. You know, like send it out, work on the next thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So formatting on a tablet is so much fun.
Dude, that's why you need what I have, man.
No, I need a keyboard.
I have a keyboard. I'm so happy with this. This is the greatest thing to write with. And now that I found an office that I can do editing and revisions in, so now I can actually like read editor comments and make my own comments. I no longer need my laptop.
Them, but I still... need a keyboard.
Yeah, the keyboard is what makes it.
Now, what model is that exactly?
So this is the Transformer Infinity.
Oh, okay.
So it's just the tablet, and then you can buy this lovely keyboard attachment, which is also like an extra 8 hours of battery.
Ooh, nice.
So yeah, and I've just got there's a basic text editor that I've been using. Where did it go? Oh, there it is.
But does it allow you to see comments and...
like, I use this for my writing, for my first draft, because it's just simple, so nothing distracts me or anything.
Ah.
Just black on white text, it's got a word count, and that's all I need. And then, just the other couple weeks ago, I found this Kingsoft Office for Android that... open. It's basically, like, it's the closest thing I've seen to Word. So, like, see, I've got all the comments on the side, I can... make revisions to stories.
Does it show you the track changes stuff, the differences? Or?
I don't know if it does track changes as much as it just goes, he inserted something here, he deleted something here.
Okay, that's track changes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen how it transposes back to Word, but hey, if I was able to edit my friend's story on the plane, thanks to this, that's one step better.
I think they must have improved that that program since the last time I used it. So.
Yeah, it's been out for a while, but I don't know if you can edit changes before.
Well, because I had it on my Asus tablet, because it was mine was the precursor to that one, where there was an attached keyboard and it kind of slid out. So, and I really like the tablet. There are a lot of good things about it, but I could never quite find a Word clone that was good for editing on the go.
Exactly. That's been my issue, is that as soon as I've done that draft, I ship it off as a text document to a laptop where I can open up Word, and now I have a big clunky laptop I take everywhere. But now that I have that, oh.
Yeah.
Because that's why I love using this, because it's so light, it has more life than a laptop.
I would say talk a little bit about some of the modern tablets during tomorrow's panel.
Sure.
On,
I totally want to push the cloud tomorrow as well. Like, I have my, I don't know if someone's done this before, but I call it my cloud beta reading, where as soon as my story, like, I've done my first revisions or something, I upload it onto Dropbox. And I go, okay, so you three are going to be my beta readers. Here's the link to that. Do not read it, or do not download it until you're about to read it. Because while you're doing stuff, I'm editing, I can put up another version. And as long as it's the same name in there, it will always be the latest version. So if you read it 1 week, he reads it the second week, and I've done edits, I'm not getting repeated stuff over.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah. And I usually just put a version number there too, so if people want to come back. But
cool.
Yeah, it's way easier than going, what version did I email to you? And here's, I think this is the latest one. And
yeah. We'll definitely talk some about that, because I know one of the primary reason I started doing the panel is just making people understand the need on how to use comments and track changes in Word. That's it. You guys would be amazed.
Along with document
format. Or maybe you wouldn't.
It's something that I really only started dealing with, I guess, last couple years or so with editors.
Yeah.
Yeah, to kind of to start to get comfortable with that. So, yeah.
Yeah. But on the writer's side of things, I haven't dealt with an editor yet in recent years that didn't use that to some extent. So, yeah. But then my own experience editing was several people who, not just not knowing how to use track changes and comments, but not knowing how to troubleshoot when they couldn't necessarily see them, how to go in and see what their Word settings were, things like that.
Yeah.
So, the more I spread that knowledge, the better. Just the basics. And then we can go into, you know, some of the one or two alternate programs that are handy, things like that.
I think one of the greatest things about writing is honestly, it's incredibly cheap.
Relatively speaking, once you have your initial outlay for certain,
you can still do the pen and paper. It'll be a little trickier, but once
you can start there anyway.
Exactly.
But yeah, you don't have to have a whole lot of equipment wise.
I don't have to continually rebuy my Word processors.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff that you're probably going to have anyway for other reasons that you can then use. You know, for
very true.
Meanwhile, writers they're the artists and their Copic markers or. I need a new tablet now to draw.
Admittedly, in this fandom, there is sometimes a feeling where it is more difficult to make money as a writer than it will ever be as an artist. But I think some of that is somewhat changing a little bit, but it's still.
Is there hope for the future of furry writing? Because. This is a topic I like to bring
up.
It's going to
be a question of are there furry readers?
Yeah. Because so many people, like, you look at the Artist Alley, people are, there's money everywhere because it's like, oh, you can quickly draw me a badge, here's $20.
Yeah.
You know, and you see a result, and it's quick, and they just look at it, and they go, that's it, I'm done. Meanwhile, a story, okay, let me read it.
And then there's people who try to do story commissions, and I'm like, okay.
I've
done exactly one of those that I did like as a it was like a contest thing that I had or something, I don't even remember what it was, and it's like, okay, I was relatively okay with the finished product, with the whole process of it. I just didn't like doing it.
I've had friends like, could you write the story? And I'm just like, wouldn't it be better if you wrote it, though? Because you have the picture
and
of what you
like,
want.
Okay,
you know what you want
to
do.
For what I would have to charge to feel like that was worth my time, to take time away from the other stuff that I want to do, nobody is going to want to pay me at least 5 cents a word, or 6 cents, which is what SIF was now calling for a rate starting, I think, in July. It's going to go up to 6 cents, or maybe it already went up. I don't know. I'm not a member yet.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's going to pay that. Maybe, I don't know, maybe if I wrote different stuff, people might be willing to, and that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that what they're going to commission is
exactly
stuff that, are you going to want to write
because,
that?
You know, I've already said I would, you know, I'm just not interested in doing adult commissions for anybody. Not because I have some kind of big moral problem with it, but just because, I don't know, I just,
it doesn't inspire
me.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I did a spate of commissions under a different name for very specific types of stories, and, okay, I managed to charge a penny a word, which was high for when it came to commissioning stories. And I had a few, you know, a couple people, loyal people who it's like, if you're ever open again, I'll commission you, which is wonderful, but I'm probably not going to open up commissions again, even if I like writing that particular material. There is an interesting thing that's kind of starting up that I think bears some talking about, depending on if any of you have looked at Patreon.
Yeah.
I'm starting to see a lot
yes.
of people get
yeah.
very active
it's
on
getting,
it, like in the last
yeah.
month.
Very
it's
popular.
Been, I'm
it
seeing
really,
like FA, it's journal.
It's like the new
journal,
Kickstarter,
like,
but
well,
for subscription.
It's fans, it's basically, it's a way for fans to crowdfund and support to motivate people to take up their creative time to write or draw or do whatever, this stuff that we're willing to support. And quite honestly, it's a beautiful model. Because I've looked at it under one of my other identities. I created a Patreon account, the sort of stuff that we'll talk about in later panels, much later at night. The idea that, okay, for argument's sake, let's say when you normally write a story to, even just a story to furry interest, there's the option of you are selling it to an anthology, you are doing, you know, this, that, and the other thing. You'll maybe, top payment for the story is $100 per printing. That's top. You know, give or take. The idea behind it, though, and I've liked the model from what I've seen so far, is that if you have 250 fans that want to see you writing this type of story, that are willing to motivate you to write this type of story, each of them tosses in $1. Mm-hmm. Now that story is worth $250. So, and again, it's very... It's slow to gain gravity, but one of the examples is a guy who does web comics who has enough of a broad fan base that they're tossing him thousands of dollars a month.
And that's the key. You have to have...
you
just
have to broaden
like
your fan base. Yeah.
You
yeah.
have to have those people in place who are willing to, you know, to then pony up for it. Because if you don't have some kind of name recognition to begin with, you're probably not going to get it through that means.
No.
You know, it's got to be something else. But have you seen Ursula Vernon had a blog post
yes.
about it? And I have to admit, I kind of agree with her viewpoint on it. Just in terms of me personally with my work, it's like, you know, I have obligations as it is. It's like I have a day job. I have to work the day job.
Yeah.
I don't want this to become. I'm fine with it being my other career. I don't want it to become my other
job. Yeah.
You know, my other quota for the day, you know. So, you know, there's that to think of. And that's all just based on your personality and whether that is like an inspiration or just, you know, a millstone around your neck. So.
And I guess it does kind of depend on, it also depends on where your inspiration is coming from. Because if you have, like me, I kind of have to divide my writing time. You know, it's like, here's this finite number of hours that I have to write. I'm very lucky in that my finite number of hours to write, you know, are grown thanks to my loving husband helping me out with that. But it's still a finite number of hours. I have inspiration column A, inspiration column B, inspiration column C. I love writing inspiration column C, and I have a lot of fun with it, and on occasion I'm going to be writing it anyways. It's nowhere near as profitable as inspiration column A. And inspiration column B kind of sits in the middle where it can be profitable sometimes. But I'm still going to go to column C on occasion anyways. If there's a group of people who are willing to motivate me and say, well, if you're going to be writing column C anyways, we'd like you to write more of it, and we'll toss you money for each item you put out. That's kind of a cool thing. But if it's at the risk of it becoming an obligation, then I can definitely see the other points.
Yeah, it's a great, you know, it's a great thing from that perspective of being able to find the people who want what you're producing that maybe, yeah, you can't necessarily get that much of an income from it otherwise, you know, and that can then, you know, spur you on. But it then you start to wonder, okay, when it's sort of about preserving your freedom to kind of choose your own projects, because then it becomes, I could see it working very well, but then I could also see it getting out of hand to the point where, again, it becomes another obligation. It's like, okay, then
is
it an artist producing something for an audience, or is the audience all of a sudden driving, you know, the artist? So, I mean, that's something that everybody, artists, writers, musicians, everybody deals with that in one way or another. We all kind of have to balance out.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and it's that question of, I think it's good to know the tool is out there, especially if it fits a niche that you can fill.
It fits so many different models, too. Like, I've seen YouTube channels, I've seen podcasts.
Yeah.
Should make the fangs and fonts preacher.
Well, and that's the other my kind of philosophy about it is, I mean, again, there's the idea of offering rewards to patrons and things like that. In some cases, though, if you are going to be producing material anyways, and this is where that model really comes in. If you're going to be producing the material anyways, but people will support you for the idea of over on the side, here's the exclusive material that only the patrons get to see that I was going to produce anyways, but I can use it as a reward.
We have a tiger?
Yes.
We have a tiger.
We have a tiger.
I'm sorry about that. I was taking a walk and talking with Articus.
That's cool.
But just kind of for a second to go back to the Patreon thing.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, we're talking about Patreon.
To kind of go back, to kind of play devil's advocate with myself, you know, I talk about, okay, you don't want the audience, like, driving to the point where, you know, you as the creator are saying, okay, you know, you stop and look around and realize I'm doing something I don't want to be doing anymore. Of course, the audience has always driven the content one way or the other. It's just that now they're doing it more directly, you know, because it's always based on what people are going to buy, you know. Publishers go with what people are going to read and, you know, what people are going to shell out money for. So that's, you know, that's always like your standard artist versus, you know, business world, you know, kind of reality.
Yeah, with the sun coming in there, turning your heat
and
down.
It's, well, because kind of like the, it kind of goes back to the whole, in the furry fandom, the adult material versus the clean material. There's clean material out there. It does sometimes get overridden by the adult material, and when people ask why, I know some artists will flat out say, because while I loved drawing this, you know, beautiful artistic piece, that guy paid me $100 or more to draw this one piece that's adult material. Then someone else paid me another $100 and another $100, and since I still enjoy drawing it, that's why my gallery has, you know, so many more adult pieces versus my small section of
Because we've all got bills to pay. So
But the idea of him on Patreon, for example, is great because
The specialty stories that will be discussed at later panels.
Well, no, this is actually a valid point of the overarching thing of why I'm just discussing it's a great thing for you. So over a year ago, he left his job and I took over our combined expenses so that he could write full time. Well, breaking into that and transitioning into that, Patreon is a great stepping stone for him to get a base income and help build a following base to kind of expand out from. So in that case, it's a great use of the service.
Well, and the other thing I found out, that because I had read Ursula Vernon's blog, and I thought she made some wonderful points, and then I looked at the settings, and I realized you can have it to where it's not a per-month thing, it's a per-piece of material thing.
Okay.
And then I say, you know, flat out in my, why am I doing this per piece of material? Because I'm still somewhat at the whims of my inspiration. And I may have a month where I put out three of this type of story, and then there may be a dry month where I'm focusing on other things, et cetera, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that they did put in there to say, well, okay, you can choose how you want to.
Which is much more fair to your readership.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've only just kind of glanced at it just from following people's links in one place and another. So yeah, I'm not really aware of all the different settings and levels that you can do with it. But yeah, I mean as a concept, I mean if you can write what you want to write or create what you want to create and get paid for it, that's the best of all possible worlds. Whatever way you're able to do it.
It's something I see MCA Hogarth using a lot of because she uses Kickstarter to fund a lot of her. Mm-hmm. Doing projects, the Patreon thing would be actually a better fit for what she does, where she funds individual chapters of comics and graphic novels and books. It fits the way she already has her business model.
You don't have to make a Kickstarter each time. Because
It doesn't have to be, this is for this one particular project.
This is a Patreon project for category blah.
Right.
Patreon
yeah.
And a lot of our, it goes back to the very Renaissance idea of the artistic Patreon. That's what it's built on. I will patron you. I will be your patron for this project.
Of course, the artist did complain a lot about those people historically too. That
a lot of those were
relationship
because it usually was not the artist's project; it was the artist's interpretation of the patron's project.
And that's where we get to the difference of because we were talking earlier about commission stories and how I had done them, but I'm certainly out of the business. But the idea of taking on a commission, you are doing what someone else wants you to do. It's, I want to see this story, this piece of art realized, and you have a steadier hand, you have a better sense of metaphor, you have whatever talent the other person has paying for it to interpret this.
Your pencil will draw that, mine will not.
Yeah. Whereas with the crowdfunding model that's kind of being set up here, which is kind of what I like about it, it's the idea of someone saying, okay, I like 90% of what you write, and if you're offering me rewards like, exclusive stuff that I won't be able to see in other places or other things that won't be available elsewhere, I'm willing to do $1 for something. Because that's the other fact, is when you take commissions, you're asking one person to shell out a lot of money for their very specific thing. When you do something like the crowdfunding idea, it's you're asking a whole bunch of people to each do a buck or two in order to encourage you to do more of this material that they like 90% of.
Yeah.
That's where it works.
The model is a much better fit because
the
commission model that works for art, for visual art does not work for writing. It's just you don't know. You're charging per word, how many words you're going to wind up with, how do you give somebody an estimate? I mean, artwork, it's like, okay, it's going to be either this size of a physical piece of paper, it's going to be this many characters, it's going to be this kind of a background, this particular media, and I charge this, and this.
Really
I know there's a few artists who've gotten to the point of like, charging by the hour, which is, more power to them if they can do it. But again, it's just try to translate that into a writing commission. It doesn't work.
And the charging the artist charges by hour is much more is an outside the fandom norm.
Yeah.
I thought they had in the quote unquote real world, you pay an artist a piece rate, supplies rate, and an hourly rate.
Meanwhile, in the furry world, they're usually going, well, a badge will take me this much, so if I divide my time up, I'm hoping to get $5 an hour or something like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There are
and at prices that are just ludicrously low for the real world for artists.
So to kind of tie this off to a different panel that was taught at this con, I did, so this is your first furry con, and one of the topics I wanted to hit on was commissioning and commissioning artists. And I actually belabored that point a great deal of, you are spoiled rotten in this fandom. Mm-hmm. To buy that same piece of Ursula Vernon art that you bought here at this con, in the real world, is 5 to 6 times more, because she's not giving you the furry discount. And a lot of artists, Dr. Tasha's, all the big artists really give you a huge discount at a furry con. But if you were to commission them from their public facing shops, paying through the nose. And writing, we can't do that.
Yeah. Well, because it's a difference, and in a lot of ways it's always kind of been true, where visual art has long been a, well, if you want a piece this size with this level of detail, here's my hourly rate, it's going to cost this much for materials, etc., and everything like that, but I'm going to make a lot based on this, you know, selling an individual this piece. Writing definitely comes more if you want it to be profitable. It's almost always been a unit sales kind of thing. At least, you know, since we had print with movable type and the Serfs gained literacy.
How many times
like
can
that.
I resell this piece?
Right.
Yeah. Because, writing, I may not be able to get one person to pay an exorbitant amount of money for this one, you know, novel, story, etc. But if 1,000 people will pay $6, $7 for it, then that's pretty decent. So.
And the trick is getting that 1,000.
Yeah,
people.
That's the biggest.
Where do you find them, and then hanging on to them and all that?
Yeah.
How
do you end up
not
placating them? So
walking that line. Yeah.
Well, yeah. There was the was it the early 2000s the. Supernatural, detective romance, Anita Blake, all of those.
Paranormal romance,
which have now turned
da Vinci
into,
Code.
Oh no, a vampire, let me take my top off. And it's written that way entirely for fan service, because that will sell. How do you maintain your artistic integrity and sell volume?
And in which I guess there does come a point where every author or every artist asks, which is more important to them? Are they trying to hit a Goldilocks zone where, you know, I have just this much integrity and just this much saleability that, you know, everything will be just right?
Volunteer to artist Sally, please.
Sorry. Okay. Or is it going to, because much as I may not find it a valid artistic endeavor, from a personal standpoint, there is something valid about, okay, we're just going to crank up the saleability, and if I crank up the saleability and I just do the fan service and everything like that, I know I can keep making a really good living off of this. I personally couldn't do that, but if you can, I'm sure you'll shed no tears on your bed made of money. And then all the way over to this, you know, where it's, I will maintain my integrity no matter what. I have to write based on my inspiration, and if that means that I only sell on rare occasion, then I have to do that. I respect that as well. But finite number of writing and artistic hours. Yeah.
It's always a balance, and there's going to be trade-offs one way or another. It's a hard sweet spot to hit between those two things, and it varies. I mean, it can vary story to story, year to year, you know, depending on what's going on, of okay, you know, whatever you're comfortable with at any given time can change too. So
Okay. Well, we don't really have an intro. So for an outro, thank you very much for being on the show. It's been great getting to meet you, seeing you guys again, meeting you, of course.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been great.
As always.
I still don't know whether to refer to you as Renee or Poet Tigers.
I do both. I mean, honestly, Poet Tigress started as an online name only, and I really didn't envision that there would be a time when people would be calling me that. So I'm okay with Renee. If you say Poet Tigress, I will turn around. I do know that's me. If you want to shorten it, you can call me PT, because I know sometimes that's not easy to just keep saying or keep typing one way or the other. But yeah, I'm versatile.
I will probably keep using Renee because that's what I was, how I was introduced to you originally.
And I find that it's how you're introduced.
Because again, that's what I write. You know,
it's
like
also
a real name, writer name, everything. So
your book is on, I think it's number 3 on my pile to read.
Oh, good.
We have a large to
it, I was going to say mine is in the hundreds. So
it was originally,
I totally understand.
It was originally down at 53, and then at the beginning of this year, I got you up to the third spot.
That's good.
Nice.
You're doing better than I am, I'll tell you.
So all those years of slush editing taught me one important skill.
Speed.
I page read. I scan the entire page into memory and flip to the next page.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And then ingest that page several minutes later after I've filled the buffer of other pages.
Well, I will admit one thing about Poet Tigress. When I was typing out the schedule, the muscle memory of my fingers constantly wanted to put 2 T's, and I had to. It's a shared T.
I keep thinking that I should almost make like an FA account with the 2 T's and just say, "No, you're supposed to go over here." I mean, I don't know if they would go with me doing that, but that's been kind. The funny thing is, there's also some people who don't know where the split is. It is Poet and Tigress. It is not Poe and Tigress. I was not doing an Edgar Allan Poe homage. Awesome as he is, that wasn't what I was doing.
I keep typing Poetry Tigress. Like finishing
the
word and then putting you in.
Like I said, if first name or PT, either one is easier, feel free. That's all good.
Thank you so much for being on. We've got Yanis. Ash walked in. Friday's been here being a little quiet.
Yep.
I'm Ocean. And
Chandra Alkani was here, but he had to leave.
But,
so.
I miss servals.
Well, we'll go requisition another serval.
Okay.
Otherwise, thank you guys for listening. We'll catch you around.
Actually,
2.5.
Yeah, 2.5.
Yeah.
Okay.
An orange, a white, and a purple.